What is up, podheads? Back with another episode of the Podio Slide Podcast. My name is Tony. I'm joined, as always, by Anthony. And we just had an epic conversation with somebody who has contributed to the podcast in the past, which was kind of cool when it came across our radar to be able to talk to Nathaniel Shannon after using some of his photography in our episode cards was kind of awesome, right?
I love when that happens, and I don't know if we've done that from a photographer front, but we have. We've had John Robbins on, we've had a few others. I love it when that happens. It kind of builds the family, right? It's we love, like, most of the episode cards that you see on socials, some of them we come up with, and, you know, it's ripping off album art or something and putting our faces on it, but most of them are photographers that we either have existing relationships with, so there's a great pipeline there, or it's people we don't even know. It's a cold call. It's a IG DM. It's an email. Hey, can we use this? And everyone's been pretty good. Yeah, but Nathaniel, when did he come? He came in for the Damien, right? Damien Moyale episode.
Yeah, our first Damien episode, which was, what, 79, I think? Way back in the summer of 21, something like that. And it was... Yeah, it was awesome that we were able to obviously find some cool photos. And this idea was your idea. I'm giving you full credit here. You were like, let's find photos of so-and-so, you know, on stage doing their thing and turn that into our EP card. And I was like, that is amazing. And it brings more people in. We've used Sean, of course. We've used Steve Levy. We've used a bunch of people over the course of, you know, 210 plus episodes. And I think Nathaniel was one of the first ones that we did it that way. So really cool, really fun. He's got a book coming out in the very near future. The link is in the show notes about St. Vitus Bar in New York City.
Yeah, it's and we've seen it. It's St. Vitus Bar, the first 10 years in oral and visual history. The back half of this combo, we really kind of dig into it. But having seen it, it's stunning. It's gorgeous. It's probably one of the most visually pleasing books that I've ever looked at. The photos are awesome, which he had. I don't know if he did all the photography in it, but he did, I think, most of it. There's commentary from bands. If you've ever been to St. Vitus, you're in for a treat. If you've never been to St. Vitus in New York, you're in for a treat. Like, this is more than just a coffee table book. This is something that it reads like a zine. The interviews are great. The commentary from bands is great. Yeah, and that's the thing, is when you bring in photographers into the Podio Slave world, like, they're creative people. The creative bounds are endless. And Nathaniel's a cool dude. I'm glad we connected with Nathaniel.
Yeah, and what you just said is perfect. If you've been to the bar and you know the vibe and you know the shows that have gone, you know, come through that place, it's for you. If you're me, who has never been to the bar but know of it by name, and we're able to look through the digital footprint of the book and see how awesome that place looks. And I mean, if you're fans of us, he has people from Killswitch. He has Damien from As Friends Rust in there. He's got members of Thursday. We've had Tucker on a couple times. Anthrax, Calling Hours, Incendiary. Like, all those people have been on the podcast with us. They contribute. So, and they've played shows at Vitus. And that place is quite the little hole-in-the-wall bar in New York.
350 pages too. So it just keeps going. And I mean, I read it. I read the whole thing in, I think, two sittings, and it would have been one, but I think other obligations got in the way. But yeah, if you like anything you've heard, if after this episode, you like what you hear, there'll be a link in the show notes. The book will be out. If it's not already out, it'll be out pretty soon. There was a big Kickstarter campaign a while ago, and I think just the final publishing and all that has to happen, but it should be coming out very soon or already out.
So yeah, let's get into our convo with Nathaniel Shannon.
Nathaniel Shannon, welcome to the show. Happy to chat with you. How you doing on this fine evening?
Thanks for having me. I am still alive. So
it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Yeah.
I think that's confirmed. a pretty good way to, you know, live life is by being alive.
It's probably the best way to live life. Yeah.
That's it. See you guys.
Yeah. We'll chat next time. So we chatted for a little bit before we started recording, but it's kind of one of these weird things where, like, we know you from the internet. So we feel like we kind of know you already. Like, there's some acquaintances, mutual acquaintances, we'll call them.
Sure.
But yeah, we first linked up, I think, via Instagram. We've used a few of your photos for like our episode promo cards on this podcast, like the Damien episode. I think that was the link, really. Damien of As Friends Rust. So yeah, I don't know how you feel. Like, are we internet friends? Is that where I'm going?
Damien is like the shitty glue that holds together the internet.
It's a great
point. Yeah, we're internet friends. We're real friends now. I know, you know, what you look like.
Yeah, yeah.
We're looking at a screen together.
Exactly. And, you know, someday we'll be able to do all this in person. But
sure.
It makes the internet does allow us to talk to people from everywhere. Right. So,
yeah, it's awesome.
And to meet people via Instagram and then end up having conversations with them like this. So,
yeah, sure.
Yeah. We're stoked to have you here. We're stoked for the stuff that you've got coming and, you know, just generally to talk music with you tonight, man.
Well, let's do it.
When we got that link up from Damien, we started following you and just have followed all your photography and obviously shows at St. Vitus, but pretty much all over New York. Like, I think you photographed Ministry last night. Did I see that?
I did.
Yeah.
So the real answer is how I'm doing. I'm feeling a little rough.
yeah.
Because ironically, like very old friend from Detroit, Jimmy Lucido, who played in a band called Bang Bang in Detroit 20 fucking 5 years ago that I spent a lot of time shooting in my infancy, is Gary Newman's drummer. So I went to go hang out with him, and Gary's been out with Ministry for, I don't know, like last year doing shows, which was awesome. And Gary Newman is like one of the nicest people I've ever met, which is cool that he's not an asshole. It's always
that's cool. Yeah,
yep. Great when you meet people and they're not dicks. He's great, and like they have a really cool family on the road, and from what I was told, Ministry is kind of the same thing. It's a lot of just people that have been with Uncle Al for a very long time. I've seen and shot Ministry a lot over the years. I would say last night was probably one of the best Ministry sets I've ever seen.
Right on.
The information I was provided is that Uncle Al is like way into mushrooms. So, and you can kind of tell because like all the colors were like very bright, and it was just like way more psychedelic and like less, you know, crawling out of under a fucking dead car somewhere in Texas to like get on stage and hide behind a fence.
Does that change how you photograph, like colors and shadows and all that stuff? Yeah, like, I mean, we're total novices in the photography game.
One of my first of many rants I'm sure that I'll go off on tonight is growing up in a world where I shot film, 35 millimeter film. Well, like for live music, everything was hot lights. So LEDs weren't implemented the same way digital photography wasn't implemented. And as digital cameras came out, the way that the sensor in the camera reads color is not the same way like film and celluloid reads color. So now everything, like everybody loves blue looks fucking cool. It makes people look cool tones. I'm a big fan of cool tones and shooting cooler personally, like in any color work I do. But how that transcribes of what they call like the Kelvin scale, which Kelvin is like how temperature is measured and color is measured, is the cooler the tones, like the more difficulty kind of like a digital sensor has to recognize that. And you just get this like weird digital artifact. I shoot a lot black and white. Obviously, digital cameras, you have the option because we live in the future. But like transferring or like moving from black and white or like converting files to black and white from color with a lot of blues, it makes black and white just very muddy and gray. And back when everything was hot lights, which were more expensive and dangerous, and like you could just do way less. I mean, like the technology, you know, it's like audio recording. Nothing beats reel to reel tape if you know what the fuck you're doing. However, you can also record cool songs on your phone. If you're a nerd about it and you know the difference and what to listen for as far as frequencies, digital artifacts, it's kind of all the same shit of nothing with LED lights, I think, is ever going to look as good as hot lights, but I also understand why and where the technology has gone, and you kind of have to adapt to that. And that's a struggle because you just have to adapt to like where technology is at. I think I was a little more of a dickhead about it like years ago of not wanting to change, but it's not up to me. Yeah, I'm right? not I'm not the emperor of cameras or stage lighting, but it makes sense. You know, I mean, like, if you, even in terms of like living in the New York City area, it's wild going to an arena like Madison Square Garden where you don't have these like massive PAs. You have something that is like a fraction of the size, but the audio quality is just like so superior that things change. So like LEDs are lighter. They're easier to set up. You have way more DMX control, like for lighting tech, you know, at the board, you can just do more. You don't have to have like gels over, you know, old hot lights were just like a color. They'd be like white and you'd have to put gels over it. It's like, it's kind of archaic technology. So there's, you know, a cause and effect relationship there that, you know, being stubborn, I didn't want to adapt with, but there's a long answer to your question.
I love how nerdy this got off the jump. Like this
it's,
is,
it's honestly something, it's something that has driven me crazy for years, within shooting in rooms that have LED lights, you know, especially like small rooms like Vitus or the only small room off the top of my head I can think of. It makes it harder and different, you know, and I could really get into like the technical side of the stuff, but I feel like we have a host of other topics that we can talk about and get nerdy about. But you have to adapt with it. And it is, I'm not going to say it hasn't been a struggle for me of having to kind of change some gear, like lenses, faster lenses. And that's all just kind of technical gear and in math that you need to know. You know, you can pick up a guitar and make cool noises, but like, can you play Eruption?
All right. Well, so you just played Eruption. Tell us how you got to the point where you picked up the camera. You know what I mean? Like where you started, like, I like this. I want to start shooting things. Sure. Maybe it's bands, maybe it's nature, maybe it's whatever. How did you get to that point?
I was really fucking bored in high school. We had one art class, or we had two art classes, which consisted of art one and art two, which I took six times. And by that, like the sixth time, I had like become friends enough with the teacher. And I think the teacher is just like, just go, you like go sit in the back. You can do whatever you want. There's actually like a storage closet and they set up just a table in there. And I just kind of got my own room that I could just go and fuck off and just do whatever. And I had a friend in high school who was going to take a photo class at the local community college in the town I grew up in, Ypsilanti, Michigan. There was a community college, Washington Community College, which unbeknownst to me at the time had this like really fucking incredible photography program. Incredible meaning like the equipment that they had like usurped what was at like University of Michigan, which is very expensive, like moderately prestigious, but like it's a real college. And I just was like, man, photography sounds like it could be cool. I guess maybe I'll take this class with you, because we were allowed to, like, our senior year of high school, do dual enrollment. So I ended up taking like a night photography class, which was cool because it's like I was 18, but I was in a class with like soccer moms and like 60-year-olds, you know, because it's just kind of like a general, it's community college, so it's like anybody can go there. And I just, the first time I saw something like an image I shot come to life in the development tray in the dark room, I just got like fucking instantly hooked. And I've kind of always been chasing this dragon of like what that magic was. You know, it's like the first
time. That's the coolest shit. Anything you can latch on to something like that.
Yeah, man. It's like you pick up a guitar the first time, you're like, oh, that's a chord or a note, or I just made a drum beat on a table that wasn't shitty, you know, like anything that you do where it's just like, oh, that's what art is. Like that, I'm satisfied with what I made versus just like throwing shit at a wall, or, you know, never really figuring out necessarily like the steps to create other things that were in my head. It seemed hilariously like a really easy medium compared to like illustration or painting or other things that like I was very interested in, but given the environment I grew up in, I just didn't really have access to like a better education of. And pretty quickly it dawned on me, like, oh, I should just take this camera rather than taking pictures of like my friends in high school trying to drink gallons of milk in an hour and then throwing up everywhere.
Wow, can relate.
We did do that. We did that too. Yeah,
there's a video.
Of course you did. Rather than just taking pictures of that, like, I should just take this to go to a show and like take pictures of bands. And you know, simultaneously at the same time, I was getting into kind of what was going on locally music wise. I had some friends that were in this like very Ween influenced band who were kind of whatever, but they used to play with this band called Cobra Youth all the time from Ann Arbor, Michigan, who were like a G.I. Joe themed punk rock band.
Nice.
There's been a few of those. There was a, wasn't Rambo that same thing? Rambo and, actually, I think there was a band from Portland named Cobra.
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah. I think G.I. Joe had a big impact on a lot of us.
Yes, he did.
But I started going to those shows and taking pictures of those. And then I went to see Cobra Youth one night at the Cobra Youth House, which is the house that they all lived in. And there's a band that were called The Oven Mitts that played. And The Oven Mitts ended up producing Jeff Tuttle, who went on to be most notable for playing guitar in Dillinger Escape Plan for a while. He was in this band, The Oven Mitts, turned in Capsule Flag. It was what I loved of Fat Records, but with like dudes ripping erections. Dudes ripping erections. It was dudes. He was ripping. He was ripping. You can leave that in there. He was ripping eruption solos, but like over these like kind of like lagwagon-y, strung out propaganda type songs. And it just fucking blew my mind that like there was this dude that could like play, who seemed like he was my age, and I could take pictures of him. And I've been following Jeff around for like the last 25 years. And like, so to watch him go from this basement show that like absolutely changed my life in terms of getting me into what was happening in my town, but then to like go on tour with him and photograph Dillinger, you know, just self-destruction and fan destruction over like the last 25 years. It's like that can kind of, you know, I would have never known that day I walked into that house that I'd be like, fuck man, that dude, you know, thanks Jeff.
That's all it takes. Well, what I was thinking of is probably before then, you're probably taking photos of maybe like images that are still, or like a landscape that's still, where a show, it's a moving target. That's a whole layer of complexity that I don't know that I've ever even thought about until now.
You know, what was interesting is at that time, in one of the like very fundamental or rudimentary photo classes I had, we had to do series about motion and like what's called like shutter drag. So like if you're running back and forth or a band's moving around, you know, you can, through the equations that is camera settings, at least shooting film, you can get your target in focus moving, and then everything else around it kind of blurs. And that's not, at least shooting film, the easiest thing to do unless you know what the fuck you're doing. It takes a lot of practice. So yeah, you're totally right. It's a moving target and it's very organic and chaotic. And I think I got drawn to that very, 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 very quickly, of being a little bit of an introvert, especially when I was younger and shy, that like it wasn't like, hey, Tony and Tony, all right, so this is what we're going to do. I'm going to direct you. I don't need to direct you because you're just going to explode in front of me. And I'm there to like learn you, you know. So for somebody with Jeff or a million of the bands I've spent like the last 25 years shooting, it's like I know what they're going to do and when they're going to do it. Like I know, okay, here's the bridge into this part of the song. That motherfucker is going to jump right here, or this thing's going to happen. And it's you can kind of anticipate the energy. You know, a couple of years ago when the pandemic happened and George Floyd got murdered and things went like all hell broke loose in Brooklyn, I spent a lot of time in the streets shooting the protests. And this sounds really weird, and this by no means has like a political connotation, but it reminded me of like how I first fell in love with just documenting this chaotic organic explosion.
Unscripted.
Happening. And you can feel it. You can feel the energy. You can feel the energy in the protests. I mean, there was some gnarly shit of like the NYPD fucking attacking motherfuckers. And like you could feel it before it happened. The same way, like you go watch a band like Dillinger play, you know, I'll just keep using them as an example, but like, you know, and you can kind of anticipate that coming. So to know, okay, what are my camera settings? What is the lighting? As we were just discussing, is it LED lighting? Is it hot light? You know, so I know when that dude jumps or like this thing pops off, I will be there to get that image that nobody else is going to get.
Yeah, you're ready. You're already already available and have everything set the way you need to. Yeah, that's cool.
And that's kind of, you know, a skill you can't teach that. I can teach you how to use a camera. I can teach you all about lighting. I can teach you how to walk into any environment and not even have to look or take like meter readings of settings, just know kind of ballpark what is going to be a good exposure. I can teach you all of that. That shit is easy. I cannot teach you how to interact with anything that happens around you. That is just a skill.
Innate, right? That's something that you see a bunch of it. It's the 10,000 hours that we always talk about. Mm-hmm. You've been in front of a lot of these. You can tell when something's going to happen. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
So early on, drawn to it, and I know that feeling, not from a photographer's perspective, but from going to your first basement show, going to the first, you know, whatever show, and you're like, there's an element of, am I supposed to be here? It's like an element of, sometimes an element of danger, but it's like this newness that just fucking hooks you. And, you know, here we are 25 years later, still hooked. So I can relate to that. How many shows have you filmed or shot? Because like, I'm just thinking from, you mentioned the garden earlier, you mentioned, you know, obviously Vitus, like there's so many changing variables that you have to put in those hours. I'm just curious how many.
I, throughout the course of the last year, have slowly been reorganizing my entire archive from like all of my film to digital spreadsheets, alphabetized by year, whatever.
I'm nerding out right now.
You know, I'm going to die at some point. We're all going to die at some point. I don't have kids, probably won't have kids. Somebody will end up having to deal with my bullshit, or they'll just throw it away and I'll disappear. Who knows? I don't care. I'm going to be dead. But like, for my own neuroses of organization and having lost things over the years, I've been putting all this stuff in a spreadsheet. So I have like a rough number, but it's probably close to like 1,300.
Wow. Yeah, I believe it. Totally believe it.
Between film and digital, like over the last 25 years, which seems like a lot. The way that like I remember things versus like seeing a number on a spreadsheet of like, oh man, it's fucking, what do you got up there? Hatebreed or the Deftones or Queens of the Stone Age at wherever this year. It seems like it would be way more than that. Cause in my head, I was like, man, there was years where it's like I did this 4 or 5 nights a week for like years. The 1,300 ish kind of just doesn't seem like it's that much.
Oh, but it is. And every one of them, every one of those nights probably has, you know, 6 different memories or 8 different vivid memories of things that happened, like getting there, getting set up, seeing the band go on, all that stuff. I mean, that's the reason we started this podcast, is to talk all that shit from the last 20, 25 years for us, like seeing those bands and maybe even talking to them at some point, which we've been able to do. So when you reduce it to the number on the screen, it feels like less than it is, but we all know it's not. It's way more than that. Yeah.
And the reason I bring all that up is it's just like getting back to the 10,000 hours. Like you cannot fake that. You can't, there's certain lightings that you could, you know, be taught at a community college that you'd never know what to do until you're in the moment. There's parts of songs that you'd have to, you know, either order the band or listen to a band or watched, you know, so much YouTube live footage to know. And it's just, it's amazing. And like we have some photographer friends, and what they do is amazing. And you kind of take it for granted. I do. Like, as someone who's been to maybe half the amount of shows you do, you get so satisfied with like just seeing the photos that they took the literal next day of the show, and you soak it in, but you don't realize how much skill and how much precision, and it's not just snap.
Yeah, I agree. You bring up a really good point of skill. You know, it's within all of that, within those 10,000 hours, within those 1300 shows, you develop style. And
right on. Yeah.
I was having a conversation recently with like a former mentor of mine who teaches photography still, a very accomplished portrait photographer. And he had just hit up a bunch of people and was like, how do you feel like you developed your style behind a camera over the years? And I wrote him back and was just like, repetition.
Right on.
Yeah. Repetition, failure. And then every now and then you get those little successes of there are certain, I remember very specific, I had lived in Georgia for a while, like 45 years ago. And there was a band from Athens, Georgia called Music Hates You that were like very much just, I hate God. And there was a picture I took of their singer with a little bit of flash, like a little bit of fill, a little bit of a shutter drag. And like the motion that that picture ended up capturing of this person, I was like, that's it. I want to chase that. I want to follow that. How do I do that more? You know, and it was like a little happy accident, but like those happy accidents, you figure out, you can backtrack and be like, oh, okay, well, what was I doing? Where was I standing? What were they doing? How, what was the lighting like? What was the crowd like? What did I eat that day? Did I take a shit? How much did I drink? Like all of these variables that go into just doing literally anything. What did you guys eat for dinner tonight? Did you go to the bathroom? Did you make sure to take a break and go to the bathroom before this? You talk to somebody, you know, all of those things affect what you do creatively. Or your day job, your interactions with your friends, you know, how often do you run into somebody that you haven't seen forever and you start talking, you're like, fuck, bad pee. Fuck, I want to talk to you more, but I got to pee. And I know if I walk away, like I'm not going to, you're going to walk away, you know? So being ready again, as you said, to like be right there and ready. And I miss that mark all the fucking time, like all the time.
Everybody does. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's something like I pull rookie mistakes constantly where I'm like, fuck, man, I've been doing this for so long. I should have known better. I shot Danny Brown last Saturday at Irving Plaza, New York. Very corporate, Live Nation, lots of rules. There's lots of rules fucking everywhere, which kind of ruins part of the fun of just being able to run around with the camera and do what I do. And I was like, well, it's Irving Plaza, it's Live Nation. Like, I can't shoot with flash. I'm going to bring three cameras and a bunch of lenses because I know what the lighting's going to be like. I've spent like years and decades in that room, yada, yada, yada. And I get there and security's like, yeah, man, you know, use flash, no limit. You stay up here as long as you want. And I was like, what the fuck are you guys talking about? That's not corporate Live Nation rules. And I didn't bring a flash. And I was like, what a fucking rookie ass mistake of... I always have that with me just in case. I never know what's going to happen. So, you know, it's like you leave your house without a spare tire. It's like, I'm just going to the grocery store.
And then nothing's
going to happen. And then I need it. And I'm like, yeah, my pictures are fine. But the entire time I was like, God damn it, dude. I know that I could have shot this like a punk rock show rather than a corporate, sterile, three songs and out, kind of boring Live Nation show that I had already in my head solidified was going to be the experience. And they're like, yeah, man, do whatever you want. And that happens sometimes. I shot a really good friend's wedding once and forgot all my memory cards and had to borrow them from kind of an arch nemesis in the music community. But I knew he had memory cards and a mutual friend was like, I'm going to call that dude, get the memory cards for you. And like having to like eat my own shit and just be like, thanks, man. I'm an idiot. Like flew home to go shoot like one of my best friend's weddings. God damn it.
But I mean, that's, we're all human and that shit happens.
Yeah, so, sure. Yeah,
you're gonna make mistakes here and there, even if you're a seasoned pro. Like I mean Anthony just had mute on, so
yeah, Anthony fucking muted. That was like forgetting flashes.
I ruined the episode. I gotta leave, guys. Sorry.
Forgetting memory cards for your friend's wedding. You know, but it's also hard. I think it's gotten harder over the years for me to just be like, you know, whatever, I'm human, and not beat myself up over the fact that it's like, you should fucking know better, dude. You have been doing this for too long. to make some rookie ass mistakes, you know. So my bad.
So I'm curious, 1300 shows, hundreds and hundreds of them were at St. Vitus.
That's another thing. Like, when I sat down to start working on this book and go through my own work, it was another, like, I feel like I've shot thousands of shows in this room. And it really was like the number was like considerably smaller, like under 100.
Wow.
That I was like, man, for 10 years, like, for real? No, I definitely shot more than that. It's just a matter of like, well, what were those shows? Some of those shows were very, very cool. So, you know, 8 not so great shows make up for the fact that like Obituary played and I was there. Mm-hmm. It's awesome.
So how did you link up with St. Vitus?
I knew Artie a little bit from just being around, and I was a really big fan of his band Gay for Johnny Depp, which I still think is the best band he's ever been in, which Artie will disagree, but fuck Artie. I love him, but I think that that band's the best. I was a big fan. I used to kind of hang out at the bar that he and other owner George worked at, Matchless, in Brooklyn. And the talent buyer, what became the talent buyer, Dave Castillo, was an acquaintance that he and his friend Fred Bakita kind of had this thing. It was like Brooklyn Vegan, but not lame, that catered more towards aggressive music.
Right on.
But at the same time, we also all fucking love Hot Rod Circuit. So like, it was just kind of like, what, you know, we love rap and we love metal and electronic music. You know, it's like pigeonholing yourself as like one spot for one specific thing. You just turn into like the New York Post of whatever your blog is, whatever your website is. Anyway, so I had met those dudes on the train going to a Converge show, and they handed me a flyer for a show that they had booked. And it turns out we all went to the same show, and like we got hammered and shot Converge, and it was great. They were still putting out good music, and we became friends, and I started shooting for their website, Chronic Youth, pretty consistently. So when Vitus came along, Dave ended up starting to book there, and I just started hanging out there all the time as a patron and just kind of friend. And they, I think, very early on realized utilizing other people's skills within the music, I say in quotes, music community of Brooklyn, that it was just like, yeah, man, you just kind of have a free pass to come here and shoot whatever you want, because
that's great.
You're documenting this thing that happens. And there's been a host of us over the years, myself, Torsten Mayer, who used to shoot a lot of the video there before Frank Quang came along. For those of people out there who don't know Frank's name, Frank has shot literally every video from St. Vitus you've ever seen, because he's extremely obsessive compulsive about documenting everything. And that motherfucker lives in that bar every night.
He lives shooting. In the basement. Yeah, he lives in the basement.
Lives in the basement under a pile of boxes. They made a little nest for him. And he snuggles up tight every night with a bunch of empty beer cans. And, you know, the smartest thing that bar ever did was to paint the logo on that back wall. Because between Frank's videos, my photos, everybody that's shot there, everybody that's taken a cell phone video, anybody that's ever made an ocular document of that room, that branding is in the back behind whoever's playing, whether it's branding. Like fucking Megadeth or Skull Shitter, who is Rob, one of the sound guys' bands. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, if you're into Skull Shitter, there's a logo. If you like Megadeth still, that logo's there. And I don't know that they like sat down, had a meeting and was like, yeah, we need to give opportunities to people as much. It was just like, yeah, man, you're here all the time. Just hit us up. We'll let you in. And that relationship just developed and strengthened over the years, as did their business, as did their booking, some of the wild underplays that they had come through. And, you know, the global recognition outside of, you know, the Nirvana thing happening in the Descendants playing and Carcass and Megadeth and Anthrax and like these big shows were, again, that logo is now fucking everywhere. And it was like free pass in a way that you can't ask or pay for the exposure, back to the exposure that we all get paid in, that they've gotten simply by everybody taking a picture or a video and that shit being in the background. So that relationship just developed over the years, and like they became really good friends. I ended up bartending there for a handful of years before the pandemic. And I just kind of was always there because for a while there was nothing else. There was really nowhere catering towards, I don't want to say aggressive music. I think one of the strongest things besides the branding that has made that bar so successful over the years was like Artie played in Era Type 11, you know? So you've got the more sensitive side of Revelation Records on top of like, oh, Judge's Boy,
oh, that's Frank, right.
You know, on top of there's questionable black metal bands that are playing the got book that somebody on the internet gets mad about. And then there's like the goth dance parties. And then there's this thing and this thing. And it isn't just like fucking metal. It's not just battle jackets and ball sweat like every night. You know, it's we all love like so many different genres of music outside of country, which would absolutely ring up high bar sales, but you just don't want to fucking deal with the headache and bullshit of those crowds. Like they've catered to like everybody in all scenes. So again, to not like pigeonhole yourself and just be like, nope, it's just metal. That also just gets kind of fucking redundant. And you shoot yourself in the foot, not only as a business, but like as a fan. And that's lended to like a very diverse palette. You know, so even when I started working on this book, I was like, I don't want it to just be, and this will probably bum some people out, of like, it's not all metal. Like Sam I Am played one of the coolest shows I've ever seen there the week after Hurricane Sandy, and there's maybe like 15 or 20 people at that show. And they came and somehow got into the city and still played. And it was awesome because it was just like, oh, they're just playing a basement show. This is just a bunch of friends hanging out who got basically stranded in the neighborhood where the bar was and like could make it there. That show was as cool to me as watching Carcass play, who I love equally in a different direction.
The reputation of the bar and the venue, it permeated. I mean, we're two dudes from Southern Maine, you know, I don't know how many miles that is, but like we've known about Vitus for, I don't know, about a decade, but pretty close to it. You know what I mean? Yes. It was, in my eyes, it filled the gap that CB's left.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to get there. And I did. Well, I got there in November for the As Friends Rush show.
Oh, right.
I went down.
Did we meet at that?
We didn't. I saw you there, and it was one of those things. It's like, I know who he is, but I don't think he has any idea who the fuck I am. So I'm going to just not engage him.
You can blame Damien for that. Fucking dick.
He's the, what'd you say? He's the shitty glue.
The shitty glue of the internet. Yeah, he holds the internet together, not like in-person stuff.
Right.
He's
fucking, you should have just DM'd him from the crowd. That's what you should have done.
We should call him right now and just yell at him and be like, you're a fucking asshole. Why don't you?
Oh, we'd go for 3 hours if we had Damien back. We've done that a few times with him.
Yeah, the 3-hour special. But like it had a reputation. It had a vibe. It catered to, and you nailed it earlier. Like you like Hot Rod Circuit, you like Carcass. Like that's us. Like anything that scratches an itch for me, and Vitus has a vibe. I can see what drew you in. Without even ever having gone there until last November, I can totally understand what drew you in. And sadly, we don't have anything really light up in Maine. Like there's nothing like that.
You've got Steve Austin's cabin. You've got the Today's the Day house.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. Have you been up to Maine?
I've been to Steve's house a couple of years ago. We went up when William Saunders and I were working on the Dead Guy documentary. We went up to film Steve and hung out with him for the day at his house, and it was awesome because he's a very old friend and a fantastic dude. So to like be at the house where like all of these classic records to me got recorded at was just like, is that, you literally like fucking set bands up in your living room and you have like your little control room. It was cool. That's the only time I've ever actually been to Maine.
I take it back. We have Geno's Rock Club is the closest thing.
which I have seen on the internet.
But yeah, it's a vibe. It's like the last of the dying breed.
Yeah, we had a lot of that stuff in the 90s. I think we had more of those places in the 90s when we were kids that right. no longer exist, unfortunately. But Geno's is still there. Yep.
Ram.
I want to dig into the book, but yeah, before sure. that, like, what is it to shoot at Vitus? Because, like, I've seen countless videos on the web. I've been there for one show, and it's very active. Like, there's a lot going on. It's a small room, I think. What's the cap? 250? 200?
250 is 250. What?
250. So it's... Average, you know, it's sweaty. It's there's not a lot of room for you to move around, like to film or to snap. So, like, what is it like to shoot shows there?
It's stressful. It's stressful because I'm 42 and getting punched in the face is not as much fun as it used to be.
Was it ever fun though? Was it ever really?
There was a time in my life where, like, being part of violent situations was more. I'm not gonna lie and pretend like it's not still stimulating. Of course it's stimulating, but like I don't, the anxiety of who am I gonna have to deal with,
sure,
is not fun the way it used to be. You know, another jaded camera guy rant is 25 years ago, if you had a camera, you probably knew what you were doing, and there was like two, maybe three people shooting. Now there's like fucking 45. And it's just kind of overkill. Side note, I shot King Diamond at the King's Theater in Brooklyn a couple years ago, and I shot King Diamond a bunch of times. One of my favorite bands ever. It was always exciting. And I got up, photo barricade, standing there. It's like, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Wow. 18, 19 people with cameras.
No way.
It's like, that's like 17 people.
It's too many.
And
yeah.
As much as I want to be a dick and just be like, get the fuck out. Like, what right do you have? I would never say that. Everybody has a right to do that.
Sure.
Everybody has a right. I kind of actually, as much as I love the barricade, because it gives me the freedom to do whatever I want. Unfortunately, as much as I would love life to be about me, it's not. So anybody should be able to bring a camera and shoot anything all the time. I think photo passes are fucking stupid. However, there's like, you know, the teeter totter of, let's say, privilege, but like credentials that I kind of question, like, how many 19, 18 people? What are you shooting for? Because now you're just kind of in your way and impeding my ability. I'm pretty aggressive in that environment because I've been doing this long enough that I know when I need to be aggressive, even though I don't seek out being aggressive. So if there's 10 people with cameras at a show at Vitus, I promise this has a point. There's 10 people up front out of 250 people. There's 240 people who now have to deal with those 10 people being in their fucking way. And that's annoying for bands. It's annoying for fans. I respect both sides of that. And like, I don't want to be in the way, and I don't want to be part of that 10 people who then is then getting looked at as being kind of a hindrance. So there's that angle of dealing with that, like, which is like slightly competitive. It's also, I'm a little more polite and cautious of my surroundings of not trying to bum out other people. Like, I don't want to stand, and I'm 6'2", not super tall, but I'm tall enough that, like, if your average height at a show is like,
yeah, you throw camera gear on top of that,
like,
yeah,
I'm in your way, you know. So like, I kind of, even at a place like Vitus, I keep my own ethical rule of like 3 songs and out, just because I don't want to like ruin anybody else's good time. That being said, I'm also there to get a job done, and I do my job, and then I leave. But like, that's led to a lot of aggressive situations over the years, which I partially understand. Like, it's kind of a nuisance having that many people. I went to the Gulch, did their last tour a couple years ago, who I think were probably one of the cooler bands of the last decade that like really brought something refreshive to that style of hardcore. I've been at a barbecue all day. I was hemming and hawing about even going, and I was like, man, I'm not even, I know what it was. I had texted Frank Quang, video overlord of St. Vitus. And I was like, how many people are there with cameras right now? And he was just like, dude, there are no shit, like so many people on stage, which that stage can barely fit a band shooting. And I was like, cool, I'm just going to come watch the show. Like, I don't have, I have this compulsion that I have to be the best one, competitive nature of getting pictures of everything. I'm just going to come and watch, man. I just want to watch this band play, and I want to watch them punch kids in the face, and I want to watch kids punch each other in the face. I don't want to worry about getting punched in the face. I just want to go like be an observer for once. And I got there, and I have the elite benefit of being able to stand behind the soundboard, and I did, and I watched a bunch of kids punch each other in the face, and it was great. And there was 20 people in that room shooting that show, and I was like, dude, that is unnecessary.
It's crazy. Yeah,
one out of every 20 people were
so for an example like that, and like there's no, again, no disrespect to those 20 people, but like if you're a fan watching somebody play, like that becomes kind of a distraction after a while. So there's like this kind of ethical median that I have of like not being disruptive, but also I don't give a fuck if I'm disrupting you because I'm here to do my job, but I'm going to do it and get out, you know? So what is it like? It's stressful. I used to not give a shit. I just bulldozed my way in there and like didn't take other people's feelings into consideration. And that led to me getting into some physical altercations over the years, which is a kind of par for the course, but like, you know, that's no different if you were shooting protests or, one of the things I remember years ago watching a documentary, which I recommend everybody watching, which was called The War Photographer with James Nakwe. James Nakwe shot fucking war. And like, it gave me the perspective of there is nothing I do in my life that will ever mean anything.
Right.
Because at the end that of is
day, the, I totally get you.
The ultimate document of how fractured and fragile and broken humanity can be, and the addiction that comes with that of being in those environments. And like listening to him talk about it, I was like, I like taking pictures of dudes that rip guitar real fast. That's like stimulating, but like, who gives a shit, man?
Right. Perspective. Yeah.
That perspective, you know, and like I think about that constantly when I go into these situations. And what I come back to is like, well, if I've already talked myself out of being there and I go, I have to just go do it, because then I'm going to leave and be like, man, I should have taken pictures of that. And I know, you know, I recognize like that's all in my head. Like that's not
totally. Yeah.
That's anything but me versus me, which has been a struggle over the years, you know, like straight up like real talk of like my own mental stability. I have like no problem talking about that. It's like it causes anxiety for me. And it's been a struggle over the years of like getting that little spark of motivation to just be like, oh, all right, man. Sometimes crowds are really cool. People are really cool. Security's really cool. And then other times when it's not, it's like, fuck, man, I have to deal with this again. I have to deal with some dude who like, I don't, you know, or a lady that maybe they're having a bad day and this is their escape. And now I'm somehow involved in ruining their escape from life. And like, they're going to attack me. I remember years ago being at Bowery Ballroom, shoot, Manor Astro, man, a bunch of motherfuckers that dress up like in spacesuits playing space surf, who I love. And this woman straight up attacked me. I had a very long beard at the time and long hair, and I was taking pictures. It was full, but it wasn't like particularly that crowded. And this woman just attacked me and crawled up on stage and dove at me and tried to tackle me, like swinging. And security grabbed her and like kicked her out. And everybody around me was kind of like, what is going on? And I remember there was a gentleman standing next to me that kind of like grabbed me and kind of helped me. And I was like, did I do something? And he was like, no, like absolutely not.
Wow.
I don't know what you guys do for work, but it's like sitting in traffic of like, what is the stressed out person going to do in rush hour right now? What is, if I just go to get a coffee somewhere, is like somebody going to flip out in public and like, you know, again, some of that's just in my head, but it's partially like people are fucking crazy.
Yeah. Well, people,
especially
definitely crazy.
Around aggressive music, you know?
Well, yeah, you're adding fuel to a fire that's probably already there for some of those folks.
Yeah, and then true.
Booze is another one of those accelerants. So 100%. Yeah, toss all that stuff in there. Booze or any other substances. But yeah, totally.
But I also love it at the same time. Right. Oh, yeah. You know.
Well, that's why we're all here, right? We all love this stuff.
It's, you know, you're kind of championing an environment. You know, you brought up ministry. Yeah, I had all access pass. I could spend as much time as I wanted up there, which was awesome as like a kind of pat on the back of like years of work. And that's cool. But I also think, like, what if ministry played at Vitus? What would that crowd and experience for me just trying to get some like a handful, you know, if I can get like three solid shots, like that's a win and an accomplishment. What would that crowd be like in reaction be like at Vitus, not at Terminal 5, which is like a massive venue with a barricade, safety and security and blah, you know,
just a whole different vibe.
It's a whole different vibe. But what would my pictures look like? They'd be drastically different.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned like the whole thing is, you know, it can get you to cause anxiety. It's a war out there. I'll say this though, from a consumer of your art, the end product is gorgeous. And
thanks.
The book, St. Vitus Bar, First 10 Years, Oral History, an oral and visual history. You sent us a digital copy of it. And I'm not blowing smoke, my friend. It's fucking gorgeous. It's
beautiful. Yeah.
It's one of those things that, like, you wouldn't think you could make a claim like that without tangibly having it. But the digital is like I have to have it. Like, I need to have it. And it's not, it's because of all the ingredients. It's all the bands I love. It's a place that I've gone to that I love. But the way it's presented, it's like, I don't know. Go buy it and we'll, you know, get into the details of how you can get it. But when did you transition to like, all right, let's actually do something with all this art, all these visuals that I've created and all these experiences? Like, when does that happen? Because the book chronicles the first 10 years, which is, what year is that?
2011 ostensibly 2020. Like, the last show that the bar had was Human Impact, which is one of Chris Spencer from Unsane's bands, and that's where the book ends. Nice. Yep. And pros and cons of the situation of making the book and where to end it was pandemic. Great cutoff.
Yeah.
The whole project kind of started years ago as I was working there, and even before I started working there, I had suggested that they, let me skip around here. So in the back room, they used to have a bunch of my old roommate Jay Morris's flyers up around the top of the soundproofing. And he had designed show posters for the bar for years and years and years. So they had like a cool collection of his work. And I was like, let's do something in the front bar. Like, I'll just curate. And by curate, I'm going to just make it all my work of, let's hang a bunch of my stuff up in there. Cause like, why not? You know, there's so much other like ephemera and bullshit and stuff people have donated and signed records by whoever has played there. Let's showcase some cool stuff that has happened in the bar. So we did a couple versions of that, of me swapping work out and in including a handful of other people, specifically Keith Marlowe and Samantha Marble, who are good friends of mine and of the bar that have really, really strong work of the place over the years. And we did that. I was bartending and I would stare at my own work every night. And I was like, why don't we take this a step further beyond like my work? There's so many talented people that hang out at that place, whether they're designers or painters or sculptors or yada, 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 that living in a city that is so fucking expensive and shitty and hard to do anything, let alone get wall space that isn't like, hey, tonight only at, you know, Tommy's Tommy's clam bar and cocktail lounge. We're having Tony and Tony's.
Too many Tonys. Too many Tonys.
Podcast flyer show. Just one night, though.
We can do that. Do it after that.
Yeah. Like 3 hours open bar. Like, that shit sucks because it takes so much work, even if it's like me, okay, I'm printing 10 photos and framing them. Like, that requires work for like one night. That doesn't seem worth it. So I had been talking with the owners about, like, why don't we try doing Vitus Presents gallery show somewhere where we can work with a local gallery, which there is a bunch of warehouse spaces that kind of did longer term event installation type things that were also in a proximity walking distance of the bar, where it's like we could have an opening party, do after party at the bar or something. And we had kind of squared it away and decided on a place a couple blocks away. That was in February of 2020. And then.
Right. Yeah.
Everything.
And
then
we all
happened.
Know what happens next.
Then we all know what happens next. And, you know, as I've done press for the book and what I'm about to say, the irony of this global event happening is I feel like people had two experiences. It was either fucking terrible, stressful, based on like their personal responsibilities, politics, finances, or you're like your boy Nathaniel here, who had like the most fun he's ever had, because in my late 30s, I was like, oh, this is what being retired is like. I can just wake up every day and be like, hey, man, I have this idea where I'm going to paint like aliens finger in their buttholes, and then I eventually am going to collect enough work out of that and like put out a zine of just like this gross work that I made to keep myself and my girlfriend entertained, which I did do. But it allowed William Saunders and I to like work on the Dead Guy documentary, which we completed, which would have not happened in the time and cost as to which it did, which ended up being this weird time capsule of the transition of technology. Of 5 years ago, we wouldn't be sitting having this Zoom podcast, you know, maybe it'd be over the phone or like whatever. Like that didn't exist 5 years ago the way that it does now, where it's like I sit fucking through meetings, marketing meetings for the company I work for all goddamn day, video chat. I don't even know in person like the people on my creative marketing team because we are all in different locations, which is awesome. What we did with the Dead Guy thing was utilize that turning point in technology. And we made this like weird time capsule about this band that like a lot of people didn't like and like kind of challenged what hardcore was in the 90s, which was awesome. So with the book, it was the kind of the same thing of like with the documentary and the book, it was like people were around and I had access to people that I might not have gotten a hold of. And me taking this idea of gallery shows and then that not being an option physically of presenting and pitching the idea of like, what if we do like a book or like a zine? I was starting small. I was like, yeah, let's just do like a bunch of zines. Like I'm just sitting here. I'm fucking bored. I've got access to my work. Obviously my old roommate, Jay, like he and I were talking of like, let's just put our collections together. There are so many shows that I shot that he made posters for. Let's just pair them up. That quickly turned into like, well, maybe we could do like 150 pages, which then turned into like 200 pages, which then turned into like 344 pages.
Right. Yeah.
And it just, as the more time I had, the more things came together, which obviously got very complicated of getting a master list of like every band that's ever played there.
Right.
And like, what do you do with that? How do you cut that down? Which there's like thousands.
Well, and you want to get blurbs crazy from as many people as you can to add, because some might be better than others, and then you got to parse through them. And it's an undertaking, man, especially as much as is in there now. I mean, shit. It's thorough.
Super unrealistic of like, yeah, man, I could do this like 6 months, 8 months. And, you know, here we are like 3 years later, and it's finally on a boat coming from the Czech Republic.
Nice. Yeah.
Well, Nathaniel, you asked like what I do for a living. I am a project manager in technology. So like I know what it takes to get things done. And as I think about the steps involved, it's like it's fucking massive. Cause like, yeah, you have the content. So you know, you have the photos. It's a good head start. But then it's, you know, curating all the interviews. Like, I mean, we can relate to that. Like there's a lot that goes into it. It's chasing people down. Hey, how can I, you know, XYZ person, you know, the list goes on.
How many episodes have you guys done?
211 or 212 at this point.
That's a fucking ton, dude.
Yeah. Oh, every week. Every week for 4+ years. We've not missed a week. I don't know how. Yeah. But
I don't know how. You know.
That's incredible.
Like weddings, kids, jobs.
Pandemic. Yeah.
That's incredible. Like, that's such a massive collection. And as somebody who consumes podcasts, all media, as we all do, I think you guys obviously know how much work this is for you for podcasts. I know 100%. Now how much work it is to, like, make a book, you know, but I don't know how much work a podcast is. Like, I can relate in terms of, like, things I've done that I'd be like, well, it probably takes this amount of time. That's a massive accomplishment for both of you. And you should be very proud of yourselves, because that's huge, you know, and to keep that going of regardless of what's going on, you know, not to turn around and make it back about me, but like, you being a project manager, like, you know, the steps. I didn't know the steps because I've never made a book. It's like very unrealistic.
Yeah. Right.
With.
But you know what, Nathaniel, if you knew the steps, you might not have started.
That's 100% true.
Yeah. To dive in first and then figure out the steps as you go. Because that's what we did with this. I mean, we had no fucking clue. We'd be doing this long out and talking to people and, you know, getting digital advances of these gorgeous books. You know, like, we had no idea that was possible at all. You know,
it's funny that you put it that way, because I've been thinking about a handful of other paper projects of my own work, and I'm enthusiastic about it, but I'm like, is this gonna take 3 years?
Totally.
Yeah. Now you know.
Now I know.
And now you'll never do anything ever again. No,
you're never gonna do anything again. No, it like, that journey and education of doing everything the wrong way and not knowing, I think, was it's the strength of the book and the weakness of the book, even to the point of I ended up just taking over full design creative control. And I had a couple layouts that were very juvenile. And Damien Moyle had been a really great resource of just me bouncing ideas off of. And I'd sent him a version at some point. And he called me and he was like, this thing is a fucking mess, dude. However, because you don't have a design style, because you are not a designer, your style is this mess.
Yeah.
And he's like, what I mean by that is, like, that bar is a mess in terms of there's flyers everywhere. There's ephemera. There's not, you know, like, it's a very well designed bar. It's aesthetically pleasing, but, like, you go in the bathroom, there's stickers, there's graffiti, and it's loud and it's chaotic. And, like, what you kind of did was present the book as the bar, like, what people see, smell, and hear in the bar is just being this, like, vomitory explosion of just shit and content and photos and posters and interviews and blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit, that's, like, kind of a really great point, which I don't know it was necessarily my intent, but as I mentioned style earlier with photos, like, the longer I worked on it, the more I kind of understood, like, oh, this is kind of my aesthetic. Is this more magazine, zine, cutout, tape together thing? Because that's what I always loved growing up looking at, more than I loved growing up looking at Taskin books, even though I have a large collection of them and they're very beautiful, very thought out and simple. The design elements are great, but, like, that's not what that bar is. It's chaos all the time whenever you walk in the doors. And I think that element is very strong. I ended up bringing on Eric Palmerly, who became kind of like design editor, because he also recognized that I was drowning and I kind of needed some help to finish it. And he really tightened it up and took kind of like my ideas and like made them actually presentable and more professional looking. But no different than like an album track listing, how it was presented from start to finish, as far as like the chronology of events in the order of which bands are presented. You know, like, I tried to stick as much to as like what the timeline was from 2011 to 2020 of it's like 75% chronological, untrue to like when things happened throughout the history of the bar, which I mainly did because to me there was like no other way to like present it other than like as like linearly as I could. It wasn't like just like list all the shows alphabetically, like that kind of made no sense to me. And if I bought the book and it was presented that way, I'd be like, fuck, man, this makes no sense.
Well, I love the way you set the stage of it, of like you, there's the Walter Forward, then there's, you know, kind of it gets into your kind of take on the whole bar and venue. And then you get into the owners and, you know, Dave on the booking side. And then there's, you know, the flyers, and you can get a sense of like, okay, because I feel like the flyers are kind of a tease of what's to come. It's like, oh shit, like Anthrax played there? I didn't know that, you know? Mm-hmm. Blink, what? Where was I, you know?
Nobody was at that.
No, yeah, there you go.
I barely even got into that.
There's a science to it, and then you executed it, and there's so many just decisions of like what font to use and what placement, and it's almost like advertising. Like in a magazine, you want to be on the right-hand side. Like you want to, that's where your ad, that's where the person draws their eyes, and it's aesthetically pleasing for sure. I gotta get my hands on the physical.
Thanks, man. I appreciate your feedback on that. I like, makes me feel like I did my job and accomplished it, you know. And the one thing that I kept thinking about was like, well, what would I want to look at? Because if I don't like it, why the fuck would anybody else like it? And frankly, I don't really give a shit what anybody else thinks, because I'm making this kind of for me of here's what I thought was cool that I could get my hands on that happened in this place for like 10 years. And if I can't be proud of it, like, why would anybody else care, you know?
Well, yeah, and you're able to use your work. You were in it, you lived it, which is always a big piece of anything authentic when it comes to art. I think if you're doing it and you're an outsider, it becomes a little more difficult. But if you were there every day, you know, you're working there, you were seeing bands there, you're shooting bands there, it feels like that when you look through the book, you know what I mean? Like it shows somebody, this is kind of my love letter to this place that I've spent a ton of time at, whether it be working or as a patron or whatever. Here it is for you guys to, here, come on in, let me show you around. That's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, I tried to, as best as I could, really make the book feel like you were in the bar, which is, I think, one of the funniest things that I came up with to pat myself on the back was doing a 2-page spread feature on the basement, because the basement fucking sucks. It's gross.
This is one of our favorite parts of the book.
It's dirty.
100%.
And every person that has ever played there has a story that is generally not favorable of that basement. However, there is also the comment of like, yeah, it's gross, and there's the piss pipe above it, above you, that like there's weird drips and smells. What has happened down here? But at least there's a place to hang out, because there's a lot of venues that size that don't have a space where like friends can run into each other, or bands can catch up with each other or other people. And I feel like I tried to capture that as best as possible between taking pictures of it and getting some like really hilarious quotes of people's experiences down there. Because even though it's just a basement, like that basement has its own identity and personality that is like equally almost as like legendary as the live room upstairs, you know?
Well, this is going to sound crazy. I'm a basement guy. Like when my wife and I went looking for houses like 8 years ago, whatever it was, I'd walk in the house, I go right down to the basement. It's like, can I finish this off? Could I have basement shows here? It's like all these opportunities. Sure. I'm in my basement right now. Like this is my sanctuary. And so Tony's not kidding. Like that's what part of the book, I just geeked out on was the fucking basement. And I'm like, and I'd never been down there. I mean, I went to the venue once, but never went downstairs. One question I had for you is, was there ever any consideration to have bands play down there? I don't know the size. I don't know the logistics of it, but like, I know like CB's basement. I went down there for a Sense by Man show years ago, you know, old Rev band.
Yeah.
And it was what you'd expect of a fucking CB's basement show. Was there ever any thought to put bands down there?
The first Sense by Man record was so good. I don't know. That's a really good question.
Yeah, have like a fest upstairs, downstairs, you know?
I think that, I mean, you probably could get away with it in some facet, but like, it's pretty tight.
Right on. Yeah.
It's pretty tight. I'm sure I would say it's like statistically implausible that like that hadn't been suggested at some point
in the
last decade. But I don't know, maybe at some point. But
yeah, any venue where the basement is its own institution, it's like, yeah, you gotta dedicate a couple pages to it. And I'm glad you did. So who looking back, like as you're compiling this and you're, you know, reviewing all the photos, you're selecting which photos to put in, any sets where you're like, fuck, I remember that set. That was a fucking special set.
I think beyond just the Vitus book, whenever I go back and look through stuff, there are fractured memories of things that like I absolutely don't remember. And I have gotten to the age a little bit of, I shot that band? Like, for real? I don't remember being at this at all. And then I'll see a picture and it'll come back to me. But with Vitus, that body of work specifically, yeah, there's a boatload that are like pretty magical events that have my non-camera memories of, but having, you know, the souvenir of those photographs just like make those are like mine. Those are my memories, you know, that I can share, obviously. But that's kind of also like what's cool about the medium in general is like, yeah, man, you could watch a video or like we could even go to the same show. You were at that As Friends Rush show, you know, back in November, I shot that. If I show you a picture that I took of that show, is that going to be aligned with the memory you have of being at that, even though we were in the same space? Maybe we weren't standing in the same area, or we obviously didn't unfortunately get to meet. It's like, what was your experience with talking to people? Like all of that stuff 10 years from now, 15 years, 30 years from now is going to like play with what those couple hours you spent in that building are going to be, you know, just so be able to like look back and be like, fuck man, the Descendants played.
Right on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like not only did the Descendants play, but like I was up front and I got like Milo sweated on me and it was awesome. And they played all of my and everybody else's favorite songs in this radical event that just very organically and spontaneously happened that shouldn't have happened and changed the course of the bar and like what they were able to like pull off, which for those that like don't know, the short version of that story is that they were playing the Brooklyn Williamsburg waterfront. It was like, I don't remember if it was like the Riot Fest brand, but they were playing festivals like them, Gorgo Bordello, the Bronx, Hot Water Music, the Bronx were playing. And it's a beautiful August summer day, and this Ghostbusters ass storm. Heck opens up the Ghostbusters trap, and just all the spirits get loose. Just came in over Manhattan, and the sky turned fucking black. Maddie gets on stage. Bronx are playing. He's like, here's your shitty future. They play shitty future. Fucking just sky opens up. They come out. They're like, show's done. Canceled. Tornado warnings.
Damn.
Thunderstorms. We run and we're like, let's just go to Vitus. Where else would we go? We go. I was with Tucker Rule Thursday and we get over there and they're like, yeah, the Descendants and Hot Water are playing.
Wow.
We're like, what? What are you talking about? Tucker actually reminded me of this when I interviewed him for the book. He's like, yeah, man, they pulled up in a pickup truck somebody had and we helped Bill Stevenson load his drums in. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, yeah, man. I was like, I don't fucking remember that at all. Because we had already been drinking all day. And I was like, for real, that happened? And he's like, yeah. And then Artie Shepard, one of the owners of the bar, was like, yeah, man, you guys like loaded in the Descendants for them. You were both very excited to do that. And I was like, I don't remember that at all. And within an hour, Hot Water was on stage. And there was like a line of kids that was like a mile long trying to get into that thing. And then the Descendants played. And it was like one of the most magic nights of... I almost didn't go to the show because the subways were fucked up and I had to take like 15 buses and walk to get to this venue. And I was just kind of like, I have a photo pass. I got to go. I think I was actually shooting for Rock Sound Magazine and it was a 4A. I was also writing like a review of the show. So I was like, I kind of have to go or I'm not going to get paid. And then it just turned into like me writing what I also put in the book because like the article I wrote on top of my pictures and the editor just hitting me back and being like, what the fuck did you just see? And I was like, I don't know, man. I just happened to be there. Yeah, you know, that was just like one of those lucky times. I just happened to be there. And that event changed the course of that bar, because overnight, the coolest band that has been ripped off a million times played the smallest show that they've probably played in 30 years front of a couple lucky nerds that just happened to make it there in time before capacity got filled. You know, so those types of memories of like, fuck, man, I got to document that. I got to shoot Obituary, one of my, probably my favorite death metal band ever. Carcass, my second favorite death metal band ever. Play these small rooms where they are not only playing to 250 like rabid fans, but also have to walk through the same crowd to get up to the stage. Yeah,
it's only one way
everybody
in, right?
else. There's only one way in, one way out, you know, as Phil Anselmo, regardless of how you feel about him, quoted as saying, you know, like, everybody's got to do the Vitus dance to get to the stage. You know,
yep.
We're all, you know, we're all equals when we play here, which, again, fuck if you like that guy or not. The point of that room will destroy your ego if you have one. Dave Mustaine, who everybody has to walk through the crowd to get up there. A lot of people don't like that. A lot of people do like that. Everybody started playing venues that size. So if you're coming and you're agreeing to do this as a bigger band, like, you know what you're in for. And I think for a lot of people, it's like, man, this is a reminder of like where we started. That is awesome. Yeah. I got that from a lot of people. One of the coolest, there was a quote from Raven from 1349. And he was like, we started playing in venues this size in Norway. And so to come back, and they've played there a couple of times, come back and play a room this size again, just reminds us of where we started. And that's so humbling and like incredible that we have the opportunity, or whatever, however the fuck you said it, to come back and like play those kinds of rooms. And like, I got a lot of comments interviewing people like that, where they were like, this just reminds us of where we started, or this has just always kind of been a home because we started here. You know, there's a lot of bands broke out of that place locally and internationally, you know, like the Bell Witches, and there's other ones I can't think of at the moment. Nothing. I mean, that band's fucking huge now. Deaf Heaven, who I think just signed a Roadrun. You know, it's like those bands got like real early shows, opportunities, like off of demos that, you know, the bar took a chance on like bringing them to town and throwing them on stage, and like they just exploded. I don't know that I want to say that bar has like set a barometer of like cool in an industry standard, but like I kind of think it has, again, with like people shooting, whether it's me or Frank's videos. Like that's kind of like the exposure that people get by being in that room and have over the years. Like obviously you have to just keep going back to the CB's comparison, because there hasn't been anything like CB's since CB's.
I love that. It's a home for people coming up, and it's an underplay option for people that, for whatever reason, like read the book. You'll find there's a number of different reasons how bands end up there. Sure. And for Tony and I, we like it all. Like, look at our interview lists on our website of every band we've ever had on. Like, there's a lot of bands that have played Vitus. Like, we've had members of Killswitch, As Friends Rust, Thursday, Anthrax, Calling Hours, Incendiary, Frank Turner, you know, you name it. So if you, I mean, look at the range of that, of those bands, it's just crazy. And there's not a lot of bands, not a lot of venues that can say that in a shorter period of time, 10 years.
Frank Turner played there twice, including opening for Mineral.
Wow.
Which Mineral did their reunion, which I included in the book. And there's going to be a lot of people say, what the fuck is Mineral metal? He, when I interviewed him, was like, yeah, man, I was flying a friend of mine over, like we flew over for the show because I never thought I'd get to see this band. And like Artie was just like, hey, do you want to play? Like last minute. And he got up and played. It was like, dude, I got to open for my favorite band.
Damn.
In this room. And like people who like both of them didn't know he was playing, and like people like lost their minds, you know. And in as a project manager, right? What better marketing than internet hype? So
totally. Yep.
Who gives a shit how many tickets you actually sell as a band? You could sell out 1500 cap room. Does that have the cool factor of you selling out Vitus?
That's a great
point. And like the fandom of the world we live in of reposts and social media and like that hype machine that kind of can be built around like whoever you are, you might get more out of just playing this like small little 250 cap room than you would a bigger venue, which is cool.
Let's jump into where we can get it. So we'll put this in the show notes, but where's the best way to find the book, to get the book once this is all going on sale? When's it hitting stores, all that stuff?
So right now we're looking at hopefully mid to late April to actually physically have them in hand. With the state of the bar right now, I don't exactly have a definite answer of what's happening. I know that we do have copies available through the St. Vitus Bar website. There's a handful left. We did a pre-order last summer, which is almost completely sold out, but we have a handful of copies left up there, and we are planning on doing some sort of release event. I will keep you guys posted of what that info is if you want to include it and plug it. But for now, you can go to just Google St. Vitus Bar. I think it's stvitusbar.com. I don't know. I don't run the website. I just make books.
Fair.
But that's the best place for now. And, you know, hopefully down the road, we can get a second run of it going and keep the perpetual hype going and get more copies into the crazy maniac fans' hands. And everybody can sit around and reminisce or get nostalgic for things that they weren't at.
Right. Well, and we'll have you back too, because like we scratched the surface. There's more here. We could totally do this again about this, or you know, just your time.
Yeah, sure.
Being a photographer in the scene. So
awesome. Well, I again appreciate you guys giving me the time to ramble at you.
Hey, gorgeous book. And if anyone who is a regular listener for us, go check it out. It's, well, I mean, I just named it, you know, what, maybe a tenth of the bands in the book. If you're like us that likes from Mineral to Carcass to Anthrax to Blink, I like it all. Go check out the book. We'll link it all in the show notes. So Nathaniel, it's a pleasure, my friend.
Yeah, thanks guys.
And we're friends now. Like it's confirmed. It's
we don't even need Damien.
No more shitty glue holding the internet together. Shout out Damien Moyel.
Yeah, he's fine. He's fine. All right, guys, have a good night, and thank you again.
Thank you for listening to Patio Slave. We are at Patio Slave on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all of the places that you can find us on social media. Facebook, Patio Slave Podcast, YouTube, Patio Slave Podcast there. Email us at patioslavepodcast@gmail.com. And hey, if you want to become a supporter, click on the link at the bottom of the episode and give us $1, give us $5. It keeps the lights on, keeps us going. We really appreciate that stuff. Thank you.
And is it Nathaniel?
Yeah.
Okay, because we have a third host. His name is Nathaniel.
We call him Nate.
But he goes by Nate.
I've listened. I'm familiar with your podcast. Oh, so nice. I'm familiar there being another one of us.
Yeah,
with he's... this blessed name.
We could have done two Tonys and two Nates, but...
I know, right?
Two Nathaniels.
Yeah.
It would have been a fucking free-for-all.
I don't know that I've ever been documented with another one of me.
Oh, right on.
Next time when you come back, we'll have Nate join us too.
Have a Nate off.
We'll have a Nate off. We'll have a Tony off and a Nate off. It'll be great.